thank you. And this is, of course, work I've done with Kristen for my thesis. And I think it's a nice continuation of what we heard this morning. You made the point very well, I think, that there's kind of lots of different choices in terms of how you want to go about modeling these. And so I want to emphasize that kind of the approach we've been taking, and the approach I'm going to talk about kind of more specifically, is really kind of going from planetary science to exoplanetary science, right? So we're trying to tap into this, all of the work that's been done for decades and decades about the Earth and then also the other planets in our solar system, and kind of trying to bring stuff from that framework into this framework. And there's some translation issues, but there always is between fields. You can also try to guess which of these slides are from previous talks and which of these slides I made during Ian's talk or since Ian's talk. So we'll see how this goes. So people have thought about atmospheric dynamics for a long, long time. All the different heat sources, the different types of winds, they speak in funny languages. Zonal winds, meridional winds, these aren't actually so funny, but in terms of really, people are used to, or planetary scientists are used to disconnecting things into different modes of thought. East-west winds, because you're rotating east-west, are fundamentally different from north-south winds, these kinds of things. Now there are two main differences between Jupiter, for example, and hot Jupiters, right? There's this asymmetric forcing, and it's very intense. There's also the slow rotation rate, because the Coriolis force acts to constrain the size of atmospheric features you can get, right? The faster it's spinning, the narrower bands you'll get. Like on Jupiter, you have all these ones. Whereas here, we expect much larger ones because we have much slower rotation. Also, this kind of has already come up some, but in terms of thinking about the general structure of these planets from very deep in the atmosphere to much higher, exactly how it's set up changes as you're moving in towards the star. So out here we have kind of some representative Jupiter-ish ones, and here are the ones we're talking about, right? Now these thick lines, this is the interior convective core, which for Jupiter comes up to about a bar, right? Really almost to the surface of the planet, whereas those aren't going to be hit in hot Jupiter until much lower down. So this changes the nature of the outer atmosphere and kind of the regime in which we're trying to understand the dynamics at work. These stellar photons should all be absorbed by a few bar or 10 bar. People can argue with that or correct me, I'm happy to be corrected. But the point is that there is going to be a gap between the atmosphere that is the weather layer, so to speak, that's being actively driven by differential heating from the star, and the interior adiabat, which presumably is equalized around the planet. You have these kind of inert layers that aren't being actively heated, but there's going to be some kind of connection between these different levels. So Ian already talked about kind of the different approaches, and I just wanted to point out that having all these different approaches is very useful, right? This idea of modeling hierarchy, and that when you're trying to understand a system, there's a difference between modeling it and understanding it. And and by modeling at various levels of complexity, we can try to pull apart different processes at work, focus in on specific components, as well as see how they might work together. And so it's really useful to take different approaches and to test assumptions and this kind of thing. It's also useful for trusting our models, which I don't really yet, but that's good. It means there's work to be done. So the approach that we've been using is taking a model that's been used for decades for the Earth and trying to adapt it to a hot Jupiter setup, right? And so far, we've been only looking at we've been using a dynamical core. We've been solving the dynamical equations with a simplified radiative forcing scheme. And this is standard practice in planetary atmospheres. And what do I want to say about it? It's pseudo-spectral. So we are solving the equations in spherical harmonics and truncating at some level, which gives us our resolution. There's different assumptions in terms of, I guess that's useful to talk about, in terms of kind of differences between, for example, what Ian's doing, where he's saying, well, I'm going to take the fluid equations, and this is a fluid atmosphere, and I'm going to solve them as such. A GCM approach is saying, well, there's these assumptions that we think are fairly good assumptions for atmospheres, and so we're going to simplify the equations with those assumptions before we try to solve them.
Doing one model, how long does it take to sort of get one model off the computer?
Yeah, so the model that I'll mostly be talking about, don't cry in, it took like 5 days to run on one processor.
Yeah, just for a couple weeks.
A couple of weeks.
On how many processors?
That's a good point. On 60 processors.
Okay.
60.
So there's some advantage to doing simplified codes.
Yes.
In the context of model hierarchy, right? And so before Ian showed more complex equations, these are kind of what they look like more when they're simplified. And we're using pressure as a vertical coordinate and instead of an actual physical height. And also, these aren't actually the equations we're solving because our code solves the equations in terms of vorticity and divergence. But same physics. This is kind of the heating that we've been using so far. This is Newtonian relaxation. So you say that the heating is defined by some relaxation profile, which you can define at every point in your model. And you find the difference between that and your local temperature, and that gives you the magnitude of your heating on some, again, defined radiative timescale.
Sigma lambda?
Oh, I'm sorry. Sigma is actually our pressure coordinate normalized to the surface pressure. So sigma goes from 1 at the bottom to 0 at the top. And then these are longitude and latitude. So just an aside on Newtonian relaxation, because now there have been several papers published using this, and it's not an astrophysical thing that people are commonly used to. So this is used, as I said, in atmospheric dynamics, and what you do, also I need to explain these plots. This is again one of these translation issues. You don't see this kind of thing in astrophysics very often, but this is zonal plots, so you're averaging east-west, and this is the temperature profile. The equator's at the center and the poles are on either side. This is, again, that sigma coordinate. So this is your surface pressure to the top of your atmosphere. And these are for Earth-like models, simplified Earth models. So you see it's, you know, hotter at the equator and cooler at the poles. And so you define this relaxation profile, and you implement that for your forcing, and then you recover some profile that hopefully, in the case of Earth, looks close to what exactly we find for Earth. Now they can cheat because they know what the answer is for Earth, so they can adjust this until it gets them an answer that looks like what we actually see.
Speaking of translation issues, can you just clarify to know, you use the term relaxation profile. However, that is not the profile to which you expect things to relax, right?
Yes.
It is effectively a forcing profile.
Right. And that's part of the point of this, right? Because this is chosen not to match what actually we see, but this is chosen to such that the results end up being what we see on Earth.
But is there any intrinsic physical worth to that thing at the top, or is it just part of a procedure to get the thing at the bottom?
Well, so this shouldn't be too far from what you actually see.
Yeah, because another way of saying this is that this is a linear, you have a linear relaxation, right? T equal to minus T. So it's a linearization around the answer. So it tells you have to know pretty close to the answer.
I'm just wondering whether the T equilibrium and the tau have physical meaning that can be useful when described.
Well, that's related to the insulation from the sun.
Linearization of the true solution, which you don't know. That would be my
But Kristen, you're phrasing it in formal terms of the solution. Adam's asking about the physics. That T equilibrium profile is presumably, supposedly, the physical forcing, the insulation of
right.
the sun. And so,
no, I would disagree with that. If you're far from purely radiative, if your true atmosphere is far from being in radiative equilibrium, then you are not in a linear regime, and so this forcing should not be the radiative temperature. So that's what I mean, it's important. It's a linear formula. It can only be used when you're close to the solution.
So this profile is not the radiative equilibrium solution.
It is not the radiative equilibrium solution for the Earth. This is what Amy was saying. This is adjusted to get the
right. But that's what I'm asking, whether there's any physical content to the thing.
But the quick answer would be no.
But is there any use to the tau that you might use? You're going to use a certain
the radiative time scale.
And so maybe that has some physical import.
Yeah, we can talk more about this. I think it's a matter of point of view, but you have to be very careful with what you do with this. I think that's.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. I'm trying to see. So
we can talk more about it. It depends whether your atmosphere is strongly radiative or strongly advective, I think. We can elaborate on this.
So you had tau written as a function only of sigma, but in principle it could be a function of latitude and longitude.
Yes, absolutely. It could be a function of latitude and longitude, it could be a function of local temperature, it could be a function of, in principle, almost anything, right? Because it's a placeholder for the actual rate of transfer.
So. One of the reasons I ask is that people sort of refer to the time constant of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And that has a time, and it, in principle it is connected with that so-called
mm-hmm.
time constant.
So, mm-hmm.
One might want to know, I'm not asking it right now, mm-hmm. what the connection might be for example, HD 80606.
Yeah. So this is one of these highly eccentric planets that comes in, and there's this concept of flash heating, such that the atmosphere kind of gets disconnected when it's close to periastron. You have this strong heating, and so you might have kind of a characteristic time scale at which the atmosphere is heated and cools. But as Kristen's making this point, it's this highly coupled nonlinear state that an atmosphere actually is. So moving along. So there's also this idea of trusting our results, especially when we have these kind of simple prescriptions, right? And so this is, again, a simple Earth model. This is, again, zonal profiles. This time it's of the zonal east-west wind. And so what you're seeing is two different codes. One's a spectral code, very similar to ours. Is it ours, or is it slightly different? And then a finite difference code as well. And what you see is these jets up in the atmosphere, and anybody who studies the Earth looks at this and says, oh, that's pretty good. That's pretty close to what the Earth actually looks like. So that's good, but what's also good is that the models agree with each other very carefully. These are two models that are, again, just solving the dynamics from the same initial setup. So the fact that they agree with each other gives us some confidence that each model is solving the equations correctly, that they're converging, right? Now, another way, is that a question? No. Another way that we can try to have some confidence in what we're getting is, especially for exoplanets where we can't look at the zonal profile and go, oh yes, that's exactly what we see when we measure in situ, is comparing different levels of complexity. So these are three different models that Adam Shulman has done with his collaborators. and they're increasing complexity, which you can tell because the plots get bigger and turn into color. And so this model is basically just the same as the ones I was talking about. It's grid-based, it's using Newtonian relaxation. This one is also using Newtonian relaxation, but this time the temperature, the relaxation temperature profiles are chosen to maybe be a little more physical, and the radiative time scales are chosen to vary with temperature and pressure instead of being constant at a given pressure level. And then this model is coupling radiation and dynamics. So similar to what Ian's doing, but from a planetary science perspective instead of from maybe the astrophysics perspective, however you want to characterize that. And so one thing that's maybe encouraging is that, oh, and if I didn't say, this is higher in the atmosphere, mid-level in the atmosphere, and lower in the atmosphere, or it's labeled here 10 millibar, 100 millibar, 1,000 millibar. So what you see generally between these different models is hot day sides, cold night sides, higher in the atmosphere, and then as you move lower in the atmosphere, you see a temperature pattern that's been more advected, and much lower down, it's more homogenized, zonally, at least. So we wanted to try comparing our spectral code to their grid-based code, and these are words that you don't need to look at very carefully, because basically what we're doing is almost exactly matching the setup that they used here. Solving the same sets of equations with a different algorithm. So we hope to see agreement. Well, what do we see? We see color, so it must be better. We see general agreement, right? So remember, we have hot day, cold night, more advected structure, more homogenized temperature structure. Like they did, we get transonic flow. So I think Ian said it this morning, but the sound speeds kind of, they change, but roughly you're looking at like a few kilometers per second is the sound speed.
Now that is a limitation in this approach because you're assuming
that. Oh, I'll get to that.
Okay.
So you're highly subsonic, or sorry, supersonic, higher in the atmosphere, and you're moving down to subsonic, lower down. You could also say that this is more characterized by being radiation dominated, whereas this is maybe more advection dominated. So you're seeing these kind of transitions through different zones in the atmosphere.
Getting the 10 kilometers per second at the terminator?
No, this is just the maximum at any through it.
I'm just wondering where it was.
Haven't looked at that in detail.
It might be the terminator, yeah. It's possible.
So general agreement. There are some differences. For one thing, we get these kind of big vortices going from the equator to the pole that they didn't see in their realization. We see kind of maybe more detail going on here.
And you're using about the same resolution?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do those figures go all the way to the pole?
Yes.
So this issue of resolution, we can maybe come back to that, but the spectral code is not supposed to be equal.
No, you said it's an equivalent resolution.
In number, but in accuracy, it's supposed to be much better. So we may have, this is what people say in atmospheric science. We can come back
compared
to
hydro.
Grid versus spectral is, yeah. Spectral is supposed to be
hydro is grid. Yeah, that's prejudice.
We can, yeah.
Yes, you are prejudiced. But I want to look at this atmosphere in another way, which is to show the temperature pressure profiles at several representative points around the globe. And I haven't looked at this in detail, I just kind of chose substellar, antistellar, and the ones around the terminator. And so the thick solid lines above 10 bar are the relaxation profiles for the night side and the substellar point. Below 10 bar, we're not heating the atmosphere, so you can kind of ignore the thick lines down there. The thinner lines in different patterns are the different points around the atmosphere. So our substellar point here is, you know, very much heated. It's hot, that's good. And there's, oh, this interesting inversion, which is not nearly as strong as these inversions, blah, 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 blah. But the point is that maybe we should remember, as some people do with very simple parameterized P sub n's, that the dynamics can change your temperature pressure profile. And your temperature pressure profile will be different around the globe. And that may or may not matter for choosing kind of a one representative profile in terms of looking at observables, that kind of thing. Another effect is these are some profiles that are along the terminator, and you can see that higher in the atmosphere, they're raised above what would be the local radiative equilibrium through dynamics, right? You have this flow from the hot day side to the cold night side, and so the terminator's heated above what you would expect. And you know, if you have an effect like this realized in an atmosphere, then you have an observational bias when you're looking at things like transmission spectra and trying to, from those data, say what the temperature pressure profile is. If you assume radiative equilibrium, anyway.
I don't think that's an important point, because most of what has been done is assuming radiative equilibrium.
Right, because it's hard to assume anything else, right.
Actually, can you just go back to so for instance, the second is inverted profile.
Yes.
You say it is above the radiative equilibrium value. Because there's two ways to get the profile. One is you can dump some energy in, mm-hmm. or you can take some energy out.
Sure. Right.
So
mm-hmm.
which one is this? Is this a,
so this...
You take it and you put dump the energy in at 0.01 bar, you're taking it out at 0.1.
Mm-hmm. How are we supposed to see that as being above the radiative equilibrium?
No, okay. Two separate things going on here. Let me say this again to try to see if I can do a better job of it. These, first, ignore the substellar profile. Looking at these profiles along the terminator, this is the relaxation temperature profile. So this is what would be...
From the terminator all the way across the night side is the same temperature profile.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so these are above that. So that's one thing. What you're talking about... through this method, we're not dumping energy at any specific level, necessarily, at any specific pressure level, right? Because our time scales, our radiative time scales are much higher up here, and our day-night contrast is much stronger up here. So you could say that we're heating more strongly up here, but we are heating throughout.
Right, but the fact that you're getting an inversion means there is the hydrodynamics
yes.
is transferring energy
right.
around.
Right. So what's happening...
Let me phrase it in a more formal fashion.
Well,
you presumably have a relaxation profile appropriate to your thin solid line there.
Mm-hmm.
Where would it lie?
This is the relaxation profile for the thin solid.
A real relaxation profile should... I mean, fine, it should be uniform on the night side, but it should have a gradient.
Yes. So from... I glossed over the details earlier, but yes, from the day side to the night side profile, we're decreasing as the cosine of the angle from the substellar point. And in terms of spatially, and in terms of the difference between the day and night, this as well is decreasing as we go lower in the atmosphere.
Does it make much of a difference if you use the cosine versus the 1/4 power of the cosine?
It does make some difference, yes, because you get, when you are higher in the atmosphere, where you're more radiation dominated, that does change the temperature structure you get up there, right? Because you tend to adjust to whatever you're forcing it to. But we haven't looked at that in strong detail.
Excuse me. I'm sorry, I'm lost.
Okay.
The only one lost. So the equilibrium profile is determined by, how did you do that? I mean, it's determined by solving the heat balance, ignoring hydrodynamics, is that right?
Yeah, so this is why I wanted to mention it earlier, because it is kind of a subtle issue, right?
How do you determine that first?
Okay, so One answer is we determined that to match the people who had done it previously, because we wanted to just match them. But the better answer is in terms of how you want to choose those profiles in the first place. It's partly guess, partly physically motivated, right? So you can take a one-dimensional model, and you can say, which is what they did, and you can say, well, this is kind of an average profile throughout the atmosphere. Now let's take this profile and say that we want a day-night contrast at a millibar of 1,000 Kelvin, and then let's have that decrease down to 530 Kelvin at 10 bar by some profile. And so it's kind of trying to be something that's not crazy, but it's difficult to determine really a good way to set that. Now going back to Brad.
Terminator profile means what? What's terminator profile?
The terminator is the line between day and night on the globe.
9 degrees from the star.
Oh, okay. At the location, okay, fine.
Okay. So going back to Brad's question, this is being changed by the dynamics, right? And what's happening is that, let me go back here, this might be useful. Is that what you see is that you expect kind of day and night based on your rate of equilibrium the entire way down. What you get kind of in the middle of the atmosphere is that your hottest region is advected east. That means that cold air is also being advected into this region, right? So this area here is actually colder than it would be if it was in radiative equilibrium. So when you look at that in a temperature pressure profile, that means that instead of following this curve up, this is cold air that's been advected from the night side.
So would that imply that there is a curve not plotted which would lie to the right of your thin solid curve?
Yeah.
Because it would be sort of the shifted terminator.
Yeah.
Shifted subset.
Absolutely.
There's a dashed line that peaks out to the right.
Yeah,
So I mean, again, this hasn't been in detail. In principle, I could plot all of my curves all over the globe, but that'd be horrible to look at. So I just chose some representative ones here.
Presumably, there probably shouldn't be any, now I'm a little confused. I was going to say that I wouldn't think that there would be any profiles that would break out of the envelope bounded by the day side forcing and the night side forcing. You don't see any here shown that get hotter than the day side.
Yeah,
but
that are out here.
But there are colder than the night side.
Ah, okay, so these, there is a little issue that at least one of these profiles, maybe both, at a couple of the top layers up here, are convective, which our code does not treat properly. So I would not trust the last few points up here. And that's something that needs to be addressed, for sure, as well as down here where you're reaching. You notice we've cut off before we expect to get to the interior radiative back. Moving on.
So did you mean by that that convection cannot occur within the system of equations solved?
Convection cannot occur within, yeah. So to treat convection in atmospheric models, the simplest, crudest approach is to test what the profile is, and if it's unstable, to adjust it to what you would expect it to be for convection. And that just hasn't been implemented here yet. But it's also not, that becomes a tricky question on Jupiter atmospheres, which we're thinking about.
Where's your lower boundary?
The lower boundary?
Compensation zone.
220 bar. So we're above the interior adiabat, we hope, but below the radiatively driven region.
How do you impose boundary conditions here?
It's sigma dot equals zero. So this sigma is, remember, pressure over surface pressure. So what's actually interesting in this model is that mass conservation becomes a surface pressure condition, which our surface pressure is free to vary in two dimensions and with time.
And at the bottom, you've got a brick wall, basically.
There's nothing flowing out or in.
But no sleep. Free sleep.
Yes. Bricks do imply frictions.
Some fancy gradient.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on. So here's a zonal profile of the zonal wind. And this is in meters per second. The number's long here. And this thick line is showing positive eastward from negative westward flow. And so you see that there's this strong equatorial jet that descends throughout much of the atmosphere. Below 10 bar, we're not heating, but we still do see some flow, which is interaction with the both layers. And in fact, since we start the model with no initial winds, then that means that any positive momentum we have here needs to be balanced by negative momentum elsewhere, right? Which does mean that this can become a reservoir from which we can drag, transfer momentum to drive the jet, which means we need to be kind of careful in terms of how we're interacting with our lower levels. But one thing I do want to emphasize is that we do run into an issue of time scales, right? The time scales, both advective and radiative, up here are very, very short. They start to become very long down here and even much, much longer here. And this also relates to some of the discussion we had this morning, and trying to relate all these different regions to each other becomes difficult within one modeling context, but does need to be taken into account, and there's plenty of work to do there. And here's the plot that was mentioned earlier. Instead of just looking at the wind speed, we can look at the kinetic energy at each level of the atmosphere throughout our simulation. So this is taking velocity squared, multiplying it by the density, and summing over the entire level, right? So this, then, you see that the kinetic energy, this is log 2, you see that the kinetic energy is very much dominated by the lower levels, right? Because even though we have the fastest wind speeds up here, we have so much less mass. So you see the jet moves down and becomes stronger as the simulation runs. You see some kind of interesting noise going on earlier in the model. And you see, let me show you this one more time. This was the big jet. And there's this other little mini jet down here, which you also see developing in the kinetic energy, right? And again, this is below where we're actively heating. And this also exemplifies how we haven't completely reached a steady state at the very bottom levels by the end of the run, which is largely a timescale issue.
In your plot of the temperature profiles, wasn't the point where they all converged just became a single line roughly also at that point?
Yeah. So what I was showing, this is how the profile, this is the initial state of the profile below 10 bar. And so you see that there is some deviation from that, which I think is actually more the temperature balancing the flow rather than heat exchange.
Is that region from 10 to 100 bars still something one should believe from the models, or is that sort of more just deep stuff that one shouldn't take too seriously?
On the one hand, you could say you shouldn't take any of these models too seriously. And on the other hand, hierarchy of seriousness. I would say that these haven't probably sufficiently relaxed. But there's also the issue, besides just relaxing, right, is that if you have a flow in the interior already existing, then having zero kinetic energy or zero velocity down here may not be the right way to interact with these deeper layers, right? So it becomes a subtle issue very quickly. But yes, don't trust these too much. Although you can't observe them through emitted properties, maybe, anyway.
So I think another way of saying is that what you see is some form of entrainment of these inert layers by the activity in the weather layer. And the question is how much of this you can, I mean, certainly the model, the physics is right, but is it the way you think it's going on in the planet, you know, as opposed to having, for instance, a convective layer that will actually drive some activity in this region. So this is actually, even for Jupiter, you know, how deep these winds go or whatever is actually an unknown. So it's a very difficult, we don't know. I think we don't know what to do about this.
We don't know, and we don't know how it may have repercussions higher up where we can't observe them.
And if I can make a small comment too, is just, I suspect EM has the same feature that it looks to, if you look at the weather layer, it looks like it's converged, right?
Right.
But the point is that you still have activity down there. This is, I mean, this point, the timescales are very long.
Right down the bottom.
And so, in fact, you really don't have, an atmosphere that's relaxed with your lower boundary conditions. So that's always a worry.
Right. Yeah. It's actually one of the reasons I kept pushing that lower boundary farther and farther down. Yes.
But you will want physically it to interact with some form of boundary condition, and we don't know what that right boundary condition is. So that's a fundamental issue, I think.
Mm-hmm. You have to match on the core.
At some point, yes.
Yes, please give me a model that goes from a few millibar to the interior. That'd be excellent.
Are you willing to say anything about thermal tides and how the gravitational tide interacts with it until you can get down really, really deep? Like, is it necessary, before we turn on, as Don was saying earlier, before we turn on the gravity that's induced by a companion, in this case, the star, do you need to know how what happens there as you go deeper?
Before you turn on the tides, do you need to know what's happening down there?
Of course, you could turn on the tides any time.
Right.
But don't you need to know what is happening to the bulk of the planet?
Seems like it'd be useful.
So,
are the gravitational tides or the thermal?
Gravitational tides.
Gravitational,
like you have all the thermal effects right here, but thermal, how they interact with the gravitational tides.
It's a very open question.
Yeah, I mean, the issue would be because most of the mass is there, maybe that's what dominates the thermal tides.
Yeah.
And this is something that hopefully will be answered when Jeremy looks at this. You can calculate the amount of, you know, the mass quadruple or whatever. You can calculate it. And where is it dominated? Is it dominated at 1 bar, 0.1 bar, 100 bar? If it's 100 bar, we're in trouble because we don't know how to drive these layers properly. That, so.
Well, and there's also, no, I'll talk about that later.
But can I just ask, what is the mechanism of this entrainment of the deeper layers? Is there
momentum transfer.
Is there a viscous transfer of momentum within the code, or is that negligible?
We don't include the viscous terms, but there is interaction between the layers.
Are they launching pressure waves?
So other gravity waves?
Yeah, I think there's various things that could be going on. There's momentum exchange. The fluid is free to. So there's various modes that can propagate. And then to answer your question, there is no extra viscosity added. So it's non-viscous.
But there's a hyperdiffusion.
A hyperdiffusion acts on the horizontal loop, not vertical.
Okay.
I'd say it's not well understood.
But yeah,
a question. Is this local minimum in the kinetic energy density an artifact of the way that you've chosen the zero point of velocity? When you start the thing up, everything is still, you generate momentum in the upper elevations going one way, the other bottom has to go the other direction to compensate.
Yeah, so I think that's true.
You say, all right, I'm going to let the bottom be.
Yeah.
Just a Newtonian velocity transformation, and that minimum in the kinetic energy goes away.
Well, it changes, is what happens. We tried running a model just down to 10 bar, so excluding the inert regions, and we got similar behavior up here, but what happens is the jet didn't descend as low. And we attribute that to not being able to kind of balance in the same way, right? Because you're really limited by what's within this box. So yeah, I mean, that definitely changes things. Moving along, because there's a few things I want to say. Shocks, yay. So you may have noticed earlier that there was kind of this temperature thing, flow thing going on here. Here I'm showing it more clearly at one of the most visible layers, although we see it throughout several layers in the model. And I've plotted regions of strong convergence in lavender and divergence in yellow. And you see that it, you know, there's occasional other spots throughout the model, but it's really striking that you've got this feature right here. Now, based on our boundary conditions, we're pretty sure that we can have horizontal sound. Well, we think we can have horizontal sound waves in our models, but we can't have vertical sound waves. Those are filtered out. And regardless, atmospheric models don't treat shocks. In the solar system, everything's subsonic. So treating this correctly, especially if that means that you're heating locally here, that can change things, and we need to be a little more confident that we're doing things correctly in terms of this.
Now, when Adam Shulman had some discontinuities that are very similar to this, mm-hmm. he interpreted those as hydraulic jumps. You want to comment on that?
That we should talk with him more. We've talked with him some, and it's kind of an issue of really determining what waves are permitted in your model, I think.
Well, I mean, you know that gravity waves are allowed, and gravity waves do connect with hydraulic jumps.
Right.
Even if you have discontinuities, though, you'll have to have some sort of way of dissipating
yep.
the energy that isn't really in these types of
That's things. Right. That's right.
So it is an issue numerically, but it's also a physical issue, and of course, Ian was showing shocks, and so
yep.
maybe not to make a pun, the two of you are converging to the importance of these transonic and maybe supersonic flow.
Well, yes, and in terms of talking about model comparisons and validity, it'll be really interesting for us to try to figure out, you know, where our assumptions break down, whether they break down, Ian doesn't make the same assumptions, so we can do some of this testing by comparing.
Because if it's true that shocks do arise generically in this context, they provide a natural physical mechanism for countering for determining the asymptotic zonal wind speed.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Without another source of dissipation, which may be necessary in Jupiters,
yeah.
Jupiters,
mm-hmm.
But may be different in these hotter Jupiters where the speeds may be getting up to very high values, and you don't have to know microscopic diffusivities or other processes that would limit the driving,
yeah.
the counter driving.
Yeah, and I think we're not. Yes, and I think we're not.
I think that were true, because then it's easier to model. It will be easier to model.
Maybe I think we'd also. I think that. There's still stuff to be done to make sure we're understanding the physics at work in this regime, because it really is so different that figuring out what instabilities may be at work, in addition to things like whether shocks can be governing the circulation.
So is it a basic assumption of the primitive equations that the horizontal motions are subsonic, or only that the vertical motions are subsonic?
I think the way you phrase it, I would say that the vertical motion is subsonic. Because you filter out the sound waves, so they're still to be very, very fast. And so you filter them out, your whole ways in hand is already done. That means infinite sound speed in the vertical.
Right.
So that's
the horizontal.
That could be separate even horizontal.
You don't have.
This is what Amy was saying. There are compressible modes admitted by the primitive. This is what she.
Sure, but you don't have the nonlinear velocity term in the equations, do you?
This is also what you said. Irrespective of that, you do need to treat this.
I'm just saying that
requires artificial viscosity.
If you don't have the V dot grad V term, then you can't handle transonic flow. because that's where Mach numbers
are. No, it doesn't matter. Even if you have
otherwise, why do you do spectral messages?
No, wait. Even if you have the full hydro equations, you need to do something about shocks because
of course,
you
know, I wouldn't be doing that.
Okay.
But I think your equations don't include the V dot grad V term.
They do. If only nonlinear, the only thing you do is that you assume the vertical hydrostatic balance.
I don't know if the
it's fully nonlinear.
Turn and the horizontal.
Apart from that assumption. So there are so-called land waves that are horizontally propagating sound waves.
Sound waves would be fine, too. I'm just talking about getting up to the nonlinear.
They can be nonlinear.
Okay, but it's not.
Can I just question?
But that's the Lagrangian. I mean, the derivative there on the left.
Yeah, it has, yeah. Can I have a simple question, side of the field? So, suppose those shocks are real and it's ubiquitous. If those shocks are such a shallow region, one would expect you know, all kinds of non-equilibrium lines, emission lines, you know, excited shocks.
Oh, there could absolutely be significant observable consequences, especially if these are transient.
Non-equilibrium lines. Well, depending on the covering effect of the shocks.
Yeah.
Largely covering this.
Well, I mean, here we see a huge extent over latitude. Yeah, I don't know, but in principle.
Yeah, like you're thinking of very extreme shocks.
All kind of weird lines, emission lines.
Okay, well, but even apart from that, if these, you know, if you do have, as Adam was saying, if this treated correctly, will help restrain the wind speeds. But if you have different time scales for kind of dissipating shocks as creating them, you could get this kind of variable condition with these strong brightenings at the shock. I mean, like, it could be, who knows? But it's interesting to think about.
I have just a basic numerical question. But what breaks the north-south symmetry? Can we put in the seed instability, or the seed asymmetry, rather?
We can include initial noise in the surface pressures of our model, but it actually doesn't make much of a difference, it turns out. You do just have some numerical noise, too.
You mean just political error? Just out of curiosity, I'm not even sure if this question makes sense, but could you calculate a Lyapunov exponent, essentially, for, like if you put in two different initial noise profiles that are slightly different, the rate at which the difference between something in your model grows could perhaps be characterized
as its coordinate?
For what purpose?
I don't know. I don't have to observe.
I mean, the stellar radiation is so large in this system that it's dominating.
I mean, I'm just curious how fast it takes for small perturbations to propagate into. I can see perturbations here.
But these are not due to initial noise. Our runs with and without initial noise. Because it's what Ian was saying, you're so dominated by the reinforcing in these upper regions. And you can get, I mean, you get.
But everything about your model is north-south symmetrical except for the whatever
where they are.
Well, if you trigger instabilities of some sort.
It's true if you have a perfectly conservative non-numerical error model, which you never have.
I'm just wondering how long it takes for the perturbations to become aggressive.
Yeah.
And that's just looking at the linear stability analysis.
I don't know from data
analysis, the modes.
I am, yeah, I'm just curious what the answer is.
Okay, I want to say a few more things. So I do think the good news is I think that there are some things that we may be fairly confident about in these atmospheres. These are things we would expect from theory as well as we see realized in the models. So this is the happy part, which is features are large, you have stronger contrasts, day-night contrast higher in the atmosphere, you have strong winds up there. But then we get questions as they relate to just this, and then even more I could go into, do we really get transonic? What do we deal with shocks? What about instabilities? Are we treating those correctly? Are we triggering them? Are we damping them? How do we interact with the lower levels? Why are different systems different? Because there's some observational evidence that they are. Lots of observational implications. Earth-like planets in habitable zones, synchronously locked. Paper this morning on AstroPH. So this regime has other applications. Right now, implementing simple radiation schemes with this code, I think that since it is still relatively simple and very fast, it can be useful to kind of figure out what's possible with hot Jupiters rather than trying to model a specific planet. So that leads to a kind of parameter space exploration to try to determine kind of the physics of what's going on here. Checking assumptions, you know, everybody likes eccentric planets. We talked some about kind of the thermal evolution of these planets with tidal effects, maybe as they interact with the atmospheres. In coffee this morning, we talked about how horrible clouds are, and at some point we might have to consider them. In terms of matching data, I think we can all agree that there's no models that accurately reproduce everything we see yet. And I just have to take a moment. This is a little bit of an aside, but this came up earlier, right? This is the beautiful map of a hot Jupiter that we have. Now, this is actually only informative in one dimension, right? So this dimension is completely made up. Fine, it's pretty, Spitzer time, rah, rah, rah. This is probably my favorite observational data, so I'm a big, big fan. This is them saying, well, let's try to go from this observed light curve to assuming you have an atmosphere with four slices with a temperature that's constant across your latitudes at a specific longitude, and try to say what our flux ratios are in those different slices. So this is maybe a little more informed than this is, right? And actually, Nick Cowan's been looking a lot about kind of trying to figure out what you can get out of data like this. And in terms of saying, like, you have a hot spot shifted this way, well, our simulations are starting to say, well, that seems reasonable. But I would point out that, I just grabbed these figures. You know, this is an old model by James Choate, old now. But if you have, you know, these cold polar features, then looking at a disk-integrated one of these, it might seem like the hottest spot is shifted to this direction because the cold spots are on the other side. If the cold spots were over here, you might have the hottest region. So there's, I just want to remind people that there's a lot of degeneracy in terms of interpreting observations.
What are the red and blue curve on the top right?
Two wavelengths, 8 micron and 24 micron.
And two different epochs, too.
Two different epochs. And then the dotted part is the time that they actually observed over, which longitude was facing them during their observations. So,
Thank you.
You said that the, well, exactly there, that the winds are strong and the temperature contrast is higher in the upper of the atmosphere.
Those seem like they're fairly safe.
So with your model, could you have a circulation that will kind of equilibrate the temperature a bit more? Because, well, the data are not all agreeing very much, but I had the impression, it is before coming here, that there were cases where the difference were high. Mm-hmm. And another case where it was not that high. So yeah. Can you reproduce the two cases, and what are the parameters that are important?
That's what I'm trying to get at. Why are different systems different, right? So for example...
Yeah, but from the model, maybe you can have some feeling about which parameter to twist to get to one or the other.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was talking about too, in terms of having a simple model where you can really kind of... Mm-hmm. I think that, I mean, we can put friction in our code, right, which is not quite the same as putting viscosity like Ian does, but it does kind of change the flow structure. If you say, well, there's something causing some form of friction, we can slow things down, it's more radiative equilibrium, less advected, that kind of thing. You can change the strength of the heating, but I think that there's going to be benefit in trying to use some radiative transfer and not relying too heavily on the Newtonian stuff. What was I going to say? Oh, right, so it's also interesting that you point out there's these different systems that some show kind of less of a day-night difference and more of a day-night difference, because I spoke a month ago saying, you know, well, there's 189, the data I showed that have actually a relatively small day-night difference. There's also Upsilon Andromeda, which has this very strong day-night difference, which Brad's student has some more. Yes. But Brad and his student have some more data on that, actually, that's showing maybe some stranger things at work that's not so simple.
Well, in broad terms, it's the same. I think the first data were 5 epochs, so exactly what amplitude you claim depends somewhat on what you fit to it.
Yeah.
So now
the inclination isn't known for that.
Yes, just empirically, the amount of variation is still large, not as large as the first epoch.
Now, when we modeled this thing, if you had an inversion of some sort, then you really couldn't say that the night side was actually cold. You don't really know that the night side is cold in this context.
We had
models where the redistribution could be quite significant for Upsilon Andromeda.
In a non-cosmic system, all you have is the absolute of the variation. So if you infer something at the absolute temperature, you have to compare that to the amount of insulation that you're getting and fiddle with that.
Which goes back to there being a large amount of degeneracy in terms of understanding
that. And what I was also referring to is that there appears to be a little more wiggle in the curve now with a better data set or higher frequency wiggles. So we're at this point, we're sort of trying to iron out what we can believe and what we can't.
And the point was when we fit those data, we could get a significant amount of redistribution, and the original interpretation was there was almost nothing coming off from the night side. I think that conclusion is not substantiated, at least by the data that have been published, but it would be nice to see what the update.
Yeah, well, I mean, hopefully in sort of a month or time, Ian will have it in the presentable state, maybe we can get up here and give a talk on it.
Yeah, good.
I just want to add to the just kind of zero order way of thinking about this, as far as the major knob of turning is balancing. This has been talked about for years now. It's the balancing of the vector timescale and the radiative timescale. So a given fluid element is hot and transfers over to the other side, and then as it goes, it cools. And so if you're cooling slowly, mm-hmm. I guess the other side is still hot. And yeah. So the major, that's the opacity.
Opacity, okay, that's great. Yeah, okay.
Well, combining those two, has anyone, you or anyone else, sort of done the test of taking your model and making simply one change, which is adding a huge opacity at some point, like Adams wants to do in his 1D models, and seeing what that does to the atmospheric dynamics?
Ian's done some work changing capacities.
Yeah, so this is in a previous model, more simplified, that you just multiply opacity by factor 10 and see what happens. And it's exactly as you expect. There's more opacity, higher the opacity, more than this.
Do your opacity sources get treated as scattering or as absorption? I assume it's absorption.
Yeah, it's absorption. But I will note that there's two opacities in the problem, right? There's the, as we talked about this morning, well, there's multiple opacities, but two really for this particular. It's the optical opacity, which is causing the day-side inversion, and then there's the infrared, which has to do with the cooling. So it's not, there may be two axes.
So about the shocks, both your shock and Ian's shock, where does those shocks typically happen? Is it in terms of longitude? Is it at noon, or is that at noon, or slightly?
Well, okay, so
20 degrees or something?
For us, in this model, this is high noon, right?
High noon, I think.
And this is now partly just around on the night side.
Oh, it's not on.
But I'll point out that
it's fairly consistent. Maybe mine may be shifted closer to the terminator a little bit, but that depends on.
It also still depends on which level you look at, right? Because it looks different a little bit at different pressures. And Adam Shoman sometimes gets them on this side. And sometimes gets them on this side.
And earlier on, didn't get any of them.
Yes.
But they were still interpreting them as hydraulic jumps. That might have been a misinterpretation.
But I think that I don't think he's looked very carefully into this issue.
Do those features depend on the resolution you are using?
They should. But
Could it be artificial?
No, I think you did try to change the resolution.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what we got.
So they're not strongly dependent on.
Well, if you go to too low of a resolution.
Yeah, of course. No.
It's not extremely sensitive.
Resolution is always an issue. It's just a matter of whether the qualitative features.
Yes, you did run higher and lower resolution, and you got the same results, basically, right?
Yes, yeah.
I'm going to do supernova work. I'm always beating over the head with resolution. You have to do resolution studies. You have to look at the L norms and all these sorts of things. Yeah.
So I'm running on reserve battery power, I've just been told. So.
Aren't we all? And that's weekend, folks.